You are listening to the very first episode of Conversations in the Gospel of John. This episode was recorded at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas, during the spring of 2023. Welcome to Conversations in the Gospel of John, where we want to bridge the gap between current academic research and contemporary proclamation of this wonderful text. My name is Stan Harstein, and my co-host is Douglas Estes.
I'm Douglas, and I currently teach at Friends University. In addition, I have a PhD from the University of Nottingham in theology, and I was a pastor for 16 years before becoming an academic.
I've been involved with teaching and preaching in Baptist congregations for the past 30 years. I currently teach at Friends University in Wichita, Kansas, and hold a PhD in biblical studies from Baylor University. We are so thankful that you're choosing to listen to our conversation.
It's great to be here today, Stan.
It's wonderful to have you here.
So why are we talking about this issue of what we learn in the academy and how it bridges the gap with the local congregation?
Well, one of the things we learn as we're studying in our master's program is that our seminary instructors are teaching us what commentators have said, and the commentary was probably written 20 years before we were born, and that's when they studied to get their PhD. And so we have a whole generations of pastors who are kind of one or two generations behind in terms of interpreting the gospel, because they're many of them just teach what they learned in seminary and aren't continuing to read.
Right.
So I think this is an opportunity for us to introduce them to some new voices in John and new methods specifically. And we're going to talk about some new methods and how they can deal with that. What have you encountered in terms of the gap between academic and pastoral ministry?
Well, I was going to say that that's right, that one of the challenges is that we tend to rely too heavily on what we've learned in the past without reinvigorating our knowledge of the Bible from an academic perspective. But I think another aspect that I would add is that one of the challenges of interpreting the Bible in general is making it come alive for readers and hearers today. And I think that a good academic approach gives us a unique perspective on the culture and language and background of the Bible. And when we learn more about those things, we feel as if the Bible makes more sense because we are actually sort of living through, in a way, what those people went through. So we have an appreciation for John's use of riddles and symbolism. These are things that we don't think about in our day-to-day life, but as we embrace more of their culture and understand more of their background, that these new modern theories sometimes help illuminate, then it helps us to make the gospel come alive for our listeners.
One of the things I've noticed that I keep trying to communicate to various people when I have the opportunity is that the modern sermon today has taken many approaches, but essentially it's simply a public presentation of a message. And so when we look at the rhetorical ways in which the gospel is designed, then how is John making its public presentation known? And if we can pick that up, then it makes preaching easier, because I think the traditional model is go in and do the exegesis, all that hard work. But the sermon is really about hermeneutics. How does this come alive today, as you mentioned? And if I don't know what made it lively in the past, I won't be able to make it lively in the present.
I think that one of the advantages of the things that we're discovering about the Gospel of John today is virtually overlooked in the modern sermon. The modern sermon tends to be didactic, and it tends to take a limited theological and historical reading of the text, whereas when we think about how the Gospel of John was read and heard in the first century, you have a rhetorical and a literary and a performative aspects that oftentimes do not come out in sermons. And as a result, it's kind of like listening to music with one headphone not working, because we're not hearing those beautiful elements in the gospel that a first century hearer would have heard in the modern sermon.
Well, we want to bridge the gap, so let's take those four terms and talk about them just a second. You said didactic, you said rhetorical, you said performative and you said literary. So let's explain what we mean by didactic.
Well, I define didactic as a reading of a text that is focused on teaching the text in a sort of boxed-in scenario so that a person learns from the text but doesn't really allow the text to breathe. It's a boxy approach to the text.
I think when, as you describe that, much didactic teaching is simply helping the listener or student have the right answer rather than experience the power of something. And so a lot of it is just, you got to have the right answer. Here's the right answer. And the pastor at the same time knows that there's three different options that he's had to look through to find what he wants to teach. So what about that second one, the rhetorical? What does that really mean in a common kind of language?
So rhetorical is a little easier to explain because the text of the New Testament, and including John, was written to convince people of things. One of the weaknesses of the modern sermon is that we have adapted a more didactic approach where it's about learning key facts than it is a rhetorical approach, which is convincing us of the truth of the argument that's in the text. And so from John's perspective, I think John is not very interested in teaching you facts about who Jesus is, but convincing you of who he thinks Jesus is and why it's critical that we believe who Jesus is.
Well, that's the ending of John. I've written these things that you would believe.
That's right.
That Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. So it's very convincing. It's not just historical. And that's how many people have been trained to think. And so we're going to be looking at some different methods as we look through this text. So the third one that you actually mentioned is literary. And you and I both have come from that particular field, which is different and distinct from the historical critical methods. When I think of literary, I think of really looking at what the text is saying in and of itself. And so treating that as a complete object rather than using it as a shovel, perhaps, to mine information in comparison to other texts. How would you talk about literary approaches to the Gospel of John?
So the literary approach is really the key to all this because John doesn't just simply want to convince us of something about Jesus. He wants us to feel it as well. And one of the ways that he evokes feeling is using literary ideas. So I can say to my wife, I love you, or I can say roses are red, violets are blue. I don't know how this really poem
goes.
Should go, yeah. But I love you. And in doing that, that is just it's a better approach. I mean, you might say it's a cliched approach, but be that as it may, I can evoke much more feeling with a metaphor, with a literary approach to talking about love than I can just by simply stating it. And so the way that we are able to feel and experience and know who Jesus is from John's gospel is to appreciate the literary function of the gospel. You can't really do that from a didactic sermon that is based on the historical critical model. You get a very limited nugget of information, like a block. What do you do with it?
Let's do a little exploration of that idea about emotive, because we all have been taught that we don't want to let our emotions lead. And we're still talking about proclamation, but in many of the churches today, they have a worship service that is designed to bring forth emotional responses, the music, the volume, the lights. And so there's that sort of response, but there's also the feeling. And so I was thinking about the difference between a Sunday morning congregation and a Sunday afternoon football game at the professional stadium, where they are loud and raucous because either A, they're emotional about their team, or they've imbibed something that probably amounts during the tailgating they shouldn't. So we don't want to encourage people to imbibe before they come to church, but to have the message actually cause them to feel something. And that's what you mean by the literary text is trying to get us to really buy into what's happening, I think.
Yes, and you mentioned football, so obviously we got to just mention James K.A. Smith's arguments about it being a liturgy. You know, it's become a liturgy for us. A lot of listeners will be aware of his work, but and I don't want to get too far afield in that, but I would just say that the challenge is, in my opinion, early modern philosophy, because early modern philosophy tried to set up and create distinctions between the emotional or the affective and, you know, the rational. And we still have these categories that I don't think existed, wouldn't have been aware of, certainly not in the way that we are in the first century. And so I don't think that John is a perfect example. Let me say it and state it in the positive. I think John's a perfect example of a text that revels in the fact that it is both knowledge but also affection or emotion at the same time. I think that I don't want to make it the Platonic ideal of any text ever written, although let's be honest, it is.
It is Platonic, that's
yeah,
for sure.
But at the same time, there's a performative value. That's the last one. There's a performative value to John, and if we don't recognize that, then we're missing the power of John.
So let's identify performative for our audience.
So performative just speaks to the fact that John, in an oral culture, would not have been read in some kind of neutral Dr. Harstein bass, James Earl Jones bass voice, and everyone would have sit there and thought, that's so profound.
Profound.
Rather, there would have been an excitement and an acting out to some degree of the gospel. We can debate, whether or not it was formally acted out, like people actually taking speaking roles and stuff. You don't have to agree with that. But the reality is that it does follow in some ways a three-person play from the ancient Greek world. And so John is aware, as a minimum, he's aware of how public proclamation in the theater, scare quotes there, in the theater occurred in the first century, and he is borrowing at least some of those ideas.
Yeah, the idea of performative is simply to say it's not bland.
Yeah.
It's not monotone. There is a excitement to it, and my thought is when John the Baptist goes forth proclaiming, you know, the Greek word oftentimes is kratzo, calling out, crying out, and that just doesn't happen at a very solid kind of decibel level. There's an increase in the volume, and for these things to be heard, even if there were fantastic acoustics of the time, the person still had to project the voice so that it could be heard by everyone else and in a way that was understood. So when we talk about these four different ideas, we're just trying to bridge the gap and realize that sometimes we bring to preaching older understandings that we haven't asked a question about in 5 years, 10 years, or 15 years. And so our conversations are simply to delve into some of those questions. Do you have any other thoughts for today to introduce about what we're trying to do with this bridging the gap?
Yeah, I would say that one of the challenges of the modern pastor in trying to teach from the Gospel of John is that, and one of the reasons why we should embrace some of these new concepts is because a lot of the limitations of the didactic approach based on the historical critical method is that it was a reaction to 18th century and 19th century approaches to the Bible that pastors in those days felt was critical for a defense of the Christian faith. But we don't live in those centuries anymore. And so we live in a century where, frankly, the average congregant may not be getting a lot of history. They may be getting a lot of opinions and a lot of ideas, but not necessarily a lot of history. And their questions are not going to be the same. We don't need to defend the gospel against historical ideas, newfound historical ideas that would occurred a couple centuries ago. Instead, we've got to figure out a way to communicate the gospel to people today.
And so the whole field of historical critical methodology was asking those kind of questions that had been started in the late 1700s and going through the 1800s and then through the early 1900s. And what we found is the more that scholarship dealt with those questions, the fewer answers they actually were able to come to a consensus on. And that caused people to start going, well, what is the text trying to say? Is because the ancient world didn't ask these questions.
That's right. And we also have the advent of modern archaeology too.
Which helps.
Yeah, which helps a lot because now we are surrounded by lots of archaeological finds, none of which explain everything, but most of which really give us a more robust imagination about the way the ancient world was that people in the 17th, 18th, 19th century could never imagine. They didn't have that information, so they couldn't visualize these things.
And one of the ways that that works out, and we'll be talking about specific passages throughout this period, but in John 5, the five pools of Bethesda,
classic example,
had always been taken in an allegorical, metaphorical means, and because they did not have five pools. And it was in the 1960s and 70s that those were actually finally unearthed. And now we find out that those five pools were five actual porticos around the pools, not five pools, but five porticos. And so that helps us understand that this account is giving a specific situation and should be interpreted differently. And the whole purpose of interpretation is simply to ask questions. So as we bridge the gap, we're going to be asking questions of other people who are here. We're going to be asking questions of ourselves and of each other, just trying to help find ways to take the academic knowledge that we've had from reading again and again and again to take that information and just make it very easily digestible and perhaps usable. And we hope to give some specific examples of how to look at John 5. So do you have anything off the top of your head about a way to make the John 5 story of the five porticos useful to someone in case they're looking for that that hint at the moment?
Well, I was going to say that the John 5 example is a great example of what you started with at the very beginning of our conversation, which is that the challenge of preaching John 5 is a tendency to want to defend, so if we go back a couple hundred years, people thought it was allegorical, right?
Right.
There's no historical.
No pools,
that's right.
No,
that's right.
Anything.
So the modern sermon wants to make sure that a person realizes this really happened, right? But they're responding to the ghosts of the past. Instead of that, that's not the question people are asking today. Nobody's asking today, is this real? Because we know it's real. So as a result of that, what was the real experience of a person who was sitting there disabled for all those years and then Jesus coming and speaking to him about getting into the pool? These are the types of questions, the healing, the faith, the experience. I'm using the word experience too much in our intro, but the experience of doing this, this is what I feel the pastor has to do to be able to bridge the gap between the academic, which allows us to see a robust image of what's really going on in John 5, and then the layperson who thinks, how does this relate to my life?
And then the other part of John 5 is that the key element in the chapter is not the healing. It is the words and the conversation that Jesus has with the leaders who are upset that this guy who's been cast out of the community for these many years is now walking around in the temple, and some guy said, carry your pallet on the Sabbath. That's where the rubber hits the road for the modern person. So those are the kinds of questions that we want to kind of deal with as we bring in a few different scholars to talk about how their work is bringing things on and to make a transition between the two. So any final words for today?
Well, I'll just add that, again, this proves the earlier argument that you made, which is the reason why we focus on the healing is because of the anti-supernatural instincts of the historical model in those centuries, those 18th, 19th centuries. And so, again, the sermon is simply responding to past problems by focusing on the miracle rather than, as you said, focusing on the Sabbath conflicts and these other issues that actually is more robust in our day-to-day life. How do we follow what God wants? How do we follow it as a Christian?
Well, as they say, God is not a God of the past.
Right, right.
God is a God of the present, right, and of the future.
That's right, that's right.
And as those who proclaim the message oftentimes find themselves feeling the should-ness outweighing the ought-ness in their sermon preparation, all these things I should deal with, rather than saying, how is God's word actually making life in my congregation right now. So, right. Well, we look forward to future conversations with Douglas and myself and some others as we come through, and we appreciate you joining us. So this is Conversations with the Gospel of John, and we look forward to our next time we come to visit. Douglas and I want to thank you for joining us for the inaugural episode of Conversations in the Gospel of John. Our next episode will feature a conversation with Irby Valdez of New Spirit Baptist Church in San Antonio, Texas. We hope you'll join us.